Continuing in number 31, we will pick up with the book of Zephaniah, chapter 1, verse 14. Zephaniah now repeats what the other minor prophets have talked about regarding the day of the Lord, especially the prophet Joel, when Zephaniah says that the day of the Lord is near and coming very quickly. It is a day of wrath, trouble, distress, destruction, desolation, darkness, gloom, clouds. And he goes on to describe eschatologically what is going to happen in the future time in the Battle of Armageddon, although it has a similarity to the soon coming invasion of the Babylonians against the southern kingdom of Judah. But it will be a day that will bring distress on all men. Sin has caused God to pour out the blood of men like dust and their flesh like horses' dung. We know that in the Battle of Armageddon, blood will run so thick that it will splatter up on horses' bridles. This is not a vain imagining or hyperbole, because in the time of Titus, when he invaded Jerusalem in 70 AD, the historians have recorded that the blood was so deep as it ran through the streets and the gutters that it put out fires which had been started to burn the houses, and fires which had been started by falling timbers and so on. And it's going to be even worse in the day when the armies of the earth gather themselves against the God of heaven. Verse 18 confirms the fact that regardless what man does, nothing's going to help him. Silver or gold, it's impossible to pay off God. The other kings throughout the history of the Old Testament had been able to pay off the Assyrian monarchs and the Babylonian monarchs with their silver and their gold to keep them from invading the land. But it's going to be in that day a time of invasion when silver and gold will not help. Zephaniah returns to the immediate future in verse 3 when he says, "Seek the Lord," in chapter 2, "all you humble of the earth." And the Josiah loyalists responded to this. Those that were backing Josiah as he reformed the nation and brought it back from the idol worship which had been established by his grandfather Manasseh and his father Ammon. And these were the ones who carried out the ordinances of God, the justice of God, and they were the ones who were seeking righteousness and seeking humility, and they responded to the message of Zephaniah in chapter 2, verse 3. Beginning in verse 4, we see the judgment on all the nations of the world, as I discussed before in the introduction to this book. Gaza is abandoned, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, these Philistine cities. And throughout chapter 2, Zephaniah, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, calls down God's judgment on these nations that have oppressed the southern kingdom of Judah during the past centuries. Chapter 3 begins with Zephaniah directing his prophecy and his judgment against Jerusalem, and he now calls her a tyrannical city. And in his scathing rebuke in verses 3 and 4, he identifies the four categories of leaders: the princes, the judges, the prophets, and the priests. And he says the princes are just like roaring lions, and we think of the New Testament comparison between Satan and a roaring lion, how he just stalks around and seeks whom he may devour. Zephaniah says the judges are like wolves at evening. They starve to death during the day, and they slink around at night and crouch around to attack the poultry in the poultry barns under the protection of darkness and the setting sun. The prophets are reckless and treacherous men because they are professional prophets and they are yes men. The priests have profaned the sanctuary. Yes, they have. As we read earlier and studied on a previous cassette, even in the southern kingdom of Judah, the priests brought in these things that allowed the people to worship Baal in the house of God in Jerusalem. And these are the things that Josiah very soon will be successful in purging from the land. Verse 8 again picks up the eschatological theme. God says, "I'm going to gather all the nations," and I think of Ezekiel chapter 38. Verse 9 says, "I will give or change all the people and they will have purified lips, that all of them may call on the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel will do no wrong, verse 13 says, and I think of Micah 4:4 as God talks about the time when Israel will be restored. Shout for joy, O daughter of Zion. Verse 15, the King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. The final verse in the book of Zephaniah summarizes the eschatological overtones when he says, at that time I will bring you in, I will gather you together, I will give you renown and praise among all the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes before your eyes. This is similar to the earlier promise of Micah in chapter 7, verse 10, when he said, then my enemy will see, and shame will cover her who said to me, where is the Lord your God? So with an eschatological promise of future return and restoration, Zephaniah terminates his prophetic message. Leaving Zephaniah in the early time period of Josiah, we now go on down through time to the latter part of the 7th century B.C. and meet the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk is going to be on the scene prior to the invasion of the Babylonians in 605 under Nebuchadnezzar, following his victory at Carchemish. We know that Habakkuk is on the scene after the fall of Nineveh in 612, because Assyria is off the historical scene and the Chaldeans seem to just be rising to power, as indicated in chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. This gives parameters of 612 to 605. However, I believe we can narrow it down even more, because we know that from 612 to 609, Josiah was still on the throne, and his reform in the land was still in effect. However, following his death in 609 at the hands of Pharaoh Necho at Megiddo, Jehoahaz ascended the throne, only to be replaced almost immediately by Jehoiakim, who sat on the throne in Judah between 609 and 597. We know that Jehoiakim was a wicked king, so the spiritual conditions described in verses 2 to 4 in Habakkuk chapter 1 could not really have occurred during the time of Josiah, but are more likely to have been taking place in the reign of Jehoiakim. So that narrows our parameters down to 609 to 605. Therefore, I believe we can accurately say that Habakkuk is on the scene between 609 and 605 BC. Habakkuk is faced with what he believes to be an ethical dilemma, because in the first chapter, he seems to be concerned over the rampant sin and iniquity which is going unchecked in the land of Judah. And he wonders why God does not do something about the corruption in Judah, which apparently is going on completely unpunished. God informs Habakkuk that he plans to punish the iniquity of Judah very soon, and the instrumentality which he will use to punish Judah is going to be the Chaldeans, a ruthless, aggressive, violent, and warlike nation, and this is what causes Habakkuk to be in an ethical dilemma. He is completely perplexed because he cannot reconcile the problem of how God, in his righteousness and holiness, can use such a wicked instrument as the Chaldeans to chasten his people Judah. He recognizes that Judah deserves punishment, but now God tells him that her godless executioner is more wicked than she is. What can be the solution to this dilemma? The prophet presents this problem to the Lord and then says, I'm just going to build a high tower and wait for you to answer me. And following this statement in chapter 2, verse 1, God presents his answer to Habakkuk. Through the answer which God gives, Habakkuk learns that God deals with men through the principle that the just shall live by faith, or the just shall live in his faithfulness, whereas the proud and wicked shall perish. That is, evil by its very nature is self-destructive, but the righteous shall live in his faithfulness. just like the Assyrians, who were described by Isaiah in chapter 10, verse 5 and following. The Chaldeans, in the same way, with a blind arrogance and pride, are completely unmindful of the fact that they are the rod of God, the chastening rod of God, to be used against his sinful nation, and that because of their own ruthlessness, they too are doomed to destruction. God's reply to Habakkuk seems to imply that the righteous or godly man exercises a continuous and abiding confidence and trust in God in the face of all adversity and trial and in every circumstance of life. And to Habakkuk, this means that the just live in faithfulness both in a time of spiritual declension, which he is currently experiencing in Judah, and in a time of national calamity, which he is commissioned to foretell. Beginning in chapter 1 in Habakkuk, he looks around and said, "Lord, I cry out to thee, violence in Jerusalem, in the center of God's chosen people. Yet you don't save," he says. Verse 3, "Why do you make me see iniquity and look on wickedness? The law is ignored. Justice is never upheld. The wicked surround the righteous. And any justice that should be present comes out twisted and perverted." It sounds somewhat like today in different parts of the world. God speaks out in verse 5 and says, "Okay, look around the nations, because I'm going to do something in your days you would not believe if you were told. I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans." There's the Babylonians. They are dreaded and feared, verse 7. Their horses are swifter than leopards. Verse 9, all of them come for violence. There are just so many of them, they just move like a giant horde across the ground, and they collect captives just like sand. They mock and laugh at kings. Any ruler of a city is just a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress. In other words, when they come up to a large wall, a large city, they don't care they have so many people. They pile up rubble and dirt against the wall, and they just go up like hordes of ants, insects, and just go over the wall and just sweep into it like the wind and pass on. When they leave, it's just like leaving behind stubble in the field after the locusts have come. There are just so many of them. Habakkuk presents his ethical and moral dilemma in the balance of chapter 1, and in chapter 2, verse 1, he says, "I'm just going to build a little guard post, a little tower, and wait and keep watch and see what he, that is God, will speak to me." God gives his answer in verse 2 and says, "Record the vision, inscribe it on tablets, for the vision is yet for the appointed time. It will not fail." That is the invasion of the Babylonians. And in verse 4, God gives the instruction that the just shall live by faith. And it is from this obscure passage in Habakkuk that the Apostle Paul picks up that theme in the New Testament in Romans 1, verse 17. To assure Habakkuk that God will judge the Chaldeans, beginning in chapter 2, verse 6, we have the destruction of the Chaldeans as depicted in five woes in verses 6 to 20. Verses 6 to 8 contain the woe because of their plunder, their blood, and their violence. Verses 9 to 11 contain the woe because of their greed and pride and cruelty. Verses 12 to 14 contain the woe because of their bloodshed and iniquity. Verses 12 to 17 contain the woe because of their debauchery of others and the wholesale devastation which they have just brought about on every nation. Verses 18 to 20 contain the woe because of the idolatry of the Chaldeans. Verse 18 says, "What profit is the idol when its maker has carved it?" It's really foolish, isn't it, to think that a man can carve something out of wood and then worship it? I recall reading a story which a missionary told many years ago. He said as he was going through the African jungle back toward the mission compound, he came upon a native who was carving something from a large tree trunk. He stopped to have conversation with the man, and he asked him, "What are you carving?" And he said, "Maybe bedpost, maybe God." In other words, however it turns out, I'll either use it at home for my bed or I'll worship it as my God. And that's the foolishness that Habakkuk refers to now. The Chaldeans just collected gods from everywhere and worshiped every god from the country that they defeated. So verse 9 says, "Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, 'Awake,' or to a dumb stone, 'Arise.' Is that your teacher? It's overlaid with gold and silver. There's no breath at all inside of it." And now the contrast, verse 20, "The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him." There's only one God in all creation, and that's the God of heaven who has chosen to make his dwelling among his people in the land of Judah. And all the earth is to keep silence before him. Chapter 3 is a psalm, and with this psalm, Habakkuk completes his entire prophecy regarding the invasion of the Chaldeans on the land of Judah. And verse 19, chapter 3, is a beautiful climax to his prophecy. "The Lord God, Yahweh, is my strength. He has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on high places." With our study of Habakkuk, we have come to the end of the pre-exilic prophets. Since we earlier studied Daniel and Ezekiel, we have completed the exilic prophets. Only three minor prophets remain to be examined, and those three are known as the post-exilic prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. However, since Habakkuk prophesied the invasion of the Chaldeans, we have a major prophet who was on the scene during the time of Josiah, as was Zephaniah. But in addition to witnessing the invasion of the Chaldeans and prophesying regarding the invasion of the Chaldeans, he also straddles the invasion of the Chaldeans in 586 and extends beyond the Chaldean occupation. This man is Jeremiah. So before going on to the last three minor prophets of the post-exilic community, we must examine the scope of prophecy and personal history of the weeping prophet Jeremiah. Turning to Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 1, "The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anathoth in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah." Jeremiah lets us know that he's on the scene during the time of Josiah, as did Zephaniah. But he gives us a little more specific time period when he says, "In the 13th year of his reign." The historical narrative of Josiah and his reform is contained in 2 Chronicles chapter 34, and as an interesting sidelight to the statement of Jeremiah, we can look at verse 8, which says that in the 18th year of his reign, when he had purged the land and the house, he began to repair the house of the Lord. You may recall that we studied this on a previous cassette, and it was during this repair that Josiah discovered the book of the law, which was hidden in the house of the Lord, and had probably been placed there during the evil reigns of Manasseh and Ammon. This repair on the house of the Lord took place 5 years after the prophetic ministry of Jeremiah began, as Jeremiah told us in chapter 1, verse 2. I cannot help but believe that the encouragement which Jeremiah gave through his ministry helped Josiah have the strength and courage necessary for spiritual reform in the land. We discussed earlier that the preaching of Nahum, which preceded the time period of Josiah, gave Josiah written encouragement through the book of Nahum that Assyria would be destroyed. Then the preaching of Zephaniah in the early years of Josiah gave him further encouragement that God was with him. Finally, this ongoing prophetic ministry of Jeremiah just crystallized everything for Josiah, and I'm sure gave him the confidence that God was with him and would be a constant source of strength as he carried out the earlier prophecy of the unnamed prophet in the time of Jeroboam I, and purged the land of idol worship. Jeremiah had a very extensive ministry because he continues in verse 3 when he says, "It also came," that is, the word of the Lord also came, "in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah." We know that he reigned from 609 until 597, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, and we know he reigned from 597 to 586. So Jeremiah is an eyewitness to all of the invasions by Nebuchadnezzar in 605, 598, 597, and 588 to 586. And he is an eyewitness to the captivity as well, because as the author of the Book of Lamentations, he looks at the desolation of the land after the Babylonians have ravaged it. Jeremiah records the call of God to him, beginning in verse 4, when he says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." Here was a man who was sovereignly selected by God before he was born, even before he was conceived. Jeremiah says, "Alas, Lord, Yahweh, I do not know how to speak. I'm not an eloquent orator. I'm just a youth." And by relying on his failure at being an eloquent orator, he reminds me somewhat of Moses. But God continues and says, "Do not say, I am a youth," as if to say that really has nothing to do with it, because everywhere I send you, you're going to go. "Don't be afraid, I'm going to deliver you." And the Lord stretched out his hand and touched my mouth and said, "I have put my words in your mouth. And you're going to pluck up and break down. You're going to destroy and overthrow. You're going to build and to plant." And God uses these rural farming terms to Jeremiah. Then continues with the first prophecy in verse 14 when he says, "Out of the north, the evil will be opened," or will break forth on all the inhabitants of the land. And it was from the north, following the Battle of Carchemish in 605, that Nebuchadnezzar came into the land of Judah. Verse 18, "Behold, I have made you today as a fortified city, as a pillar of iron, and as walls of bronze against the whole land, to the kings of Judah, to its princes, to its priests, and to the people." And Jeremiah is going to need this kind of encouragement and this kind of physical fortification, because verse 19 says, "They will fight against you, but they will not overcome you." And he has given Jeremiah the kind of protection symbolically that he gave Ezekiel a little later on. It is necessary to understand the basic overall concept of the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah's central theme will be, this judgment is from God. God is sending the Babylonians on the land of Judah as a chastening rod because the inhabitants of the land have been evil. This is in accordance with the theme of Habakkuk, which will be pronounced in just a very few years. So both Habakkuk and Jeremiah have the same message. The Chaldeans are coming in. They are sent from God. They are sent as a chastening rod because there is so much violence in the city. Jeremiah's message has a little different tone, however. When he presents these concepts, he follows them up by saying, "You must not resist." And this is the central theme of Jeremiah's message. Don't resist the Babylonians. Bend your neck in submission. Realize that God is sending them to chasten you. Take your punishment. In other words, take your licks, which you deserve, and then God will deliver you when he is ready. Well, the inhabitants of Judah do not want to hear this kind of message. They want to resist this invading army, and because they want to resist, and because Jeremiah is preaching surrender, they do not recognize the message which Jeremiah is preaching as being from God, and they accuse him of being a traitor and charge him with treason. So throughout his entire ministry, he will be rejected by everyone as a traitor and as one who preaches treason. He is a weeping prophet because he is rejected personally, because he sees the calamity which will come on the land, and because he preaches a message which no one wants to hear. To outline the book of Jeremiah, we have to understand that His prophecies are not arranged in chronological order. For example, his prophecies under Josiah in chapters 1 to 20 are followed by a prophecy in the reign of Zedekiah in chapter 21, who was the last king of Judah. There were actually three kings whose reigns intervened between Josiah and Zedekiah. We learned earlier that these were the reigns of Jehoahaz in 609, Jehoiakim 609 to 597, and Jehoiakim in 597. So the reigns of those three men are completely passed over, even though Jeremiah is on the scene. Again, chapters 35 and 36 precede in time chapters 27 through 34. Many reasons have been given to explain why the book is arranged in this order. Some expositors, such as Kyle, have suggested that Jeremiah arranged his book topically, according to subject matter. Other expositors have said that certain portions circulated independently in small, separate collections and were gathered together later. Still other expositors explain the character of the book by the nature of its composition, saying that the earlier prophecies were destroyed and were redictated with additions, for example, chapter 36, verse 32, while later prophecies were collected and edited by Baruch. Finally, Unger states that the fact that the book was written in stages suggests why it is not arranged in strict chronological order. The principle of arrangement is just not easy to ascertain. The general arrangement of the prophecies is discernible because they are divided in accordance with their contents. Those concerning Judah and the future messianic kingdom come first in chapters 1 to 45, and these are followed by the prophecies concerning foreign nations in chapters 46 to 51, and finally, an historical appendix is the final chapter in the book. I would like to give you an outline which is arranged according to the reigns of the rulers under which Jeremiah prophesied. Prophecies under Josiah and Jehoiakim are contained in chapters 2 through 20. Prophecies which were delivered only under Jehoiakim are in chapters 25 to 27, chapters 35 to 36, chapter 45, chapter 45:1 through chapter 45:33. Prophecies which were under the reign of Zedekiah are in chapters 21 to 24, chapters 28 to 34, chapters 37 to 39, chapter 49, verse 34, through chapter 51, verse 64. Prophecies and events under Gedaliah are recorded in chapters 40 to 42. Jeremiah's ministry in Egypt is recorded in chapters 43 and 44. And the historical appendix is chapter 52. This is the end of side 1.